Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Hydraulic fracturing has been around for decades. It's been used out west to pry natural gas locked in underground shale. But now it's moving east and bringing with it a lot of controversy and environmental worries. Fracking is a process where a natural gas company blasts millions of gallons of water and chemicals and sand into the ground to blast apart shale, which is like concrete. When the shale is blown apart, the companies can capture the natural gas. The problem is some people are finding the process contaminates groundwater. Ohio, as well as Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and New York are prime for this type of drilling because they sit on the Marcellus Shale. A third to a half of Ohio sits on this shale. Joining us now to give us an overview of this controversy, of this process, is Mike Sorahan of Greenwire. It's a news outlet that reports on energy and the environment, and some of his stories have been published on the New York Times website. Mike Sorahan, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
Mike, why can't natural gas companies just drill for the gas in the Marcellus Shale and get it out?
Well, you cannot get gas out of shale without fracturing. Fracturing is a pretty common drilling technique. It's been used in various in all forms of conventional and unconventional drilling for a long time. And there's a lot of there's tens of thousands of wells already in Ohio of conventional drilling, and fracturing has been used in a lot of those. But generally, in the past, it's been used very commonly, but it's not necessary to get the gas. It enhances your ability to get more gas. Mm-hmm. With shale, it's absolutely necessary because the rock is so dense, so thick, so concrete-like. And the other thing that they have, the real innovation that allowed people to get at this shale is that they were able to do hydraulic fracturing and also directional drilling. So whereas previously they sunk something straight down and fractured, once they were able to turn the drill bit and still fracture, they could get at this gas.
So basically the drill bit comes down and takes a right angle, a turn.
Right.
So it comes in horizontal at the bottom. It's not just drilling straight down.
Right.
How much natural gas can be released by this process?
Shale, in general, the four or five major shale plays that have been developed now in the past couple of years have doubled the U.S. supply. Just it's kind of a paradigm shift in energy. I mean, it promises in a lot of ways they're trying. Some people say it could replace coal,
mm-hmm.
Or at least significantly diminish its use, which would reduce pollution, et cetera.
Why is there so much natural gas in the shale? What makes it so special?
It's not that special. Everybody. Geologists have known for decades that rock was laced with gas. It's a fairly common formation of rock. It was just too hard to get at. Mm-hmm. The formation was too dense. It was too hard, too tight. And really, you go back about, the history of this goes back about 17 or so years to this one guy in Texas who wanted to. He owned a gas company and he was worried about running out of supplies, and he kept telling his crews to try this Barnett shale layer, and his crews would say, "You're crazy. You can't get the gas out of there." And he'd say, "Just do it." He spent a couple $1 million on this and finally found the right formula, and got bought out a couple years later by a company called Devon for a couple billion.
Wow. 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. We're talking about hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, the process of using water and some chemicals and sand to basically blast apart shale underground and then extract the natural gas from it. Our guest this segment of All Sides is Mike Sorahan. He's an environmental and energy reporter for Greenwire. Mike, could you just – I sort of briefly laid out what the process is, but what does a fracking drill site look like? What's going on there?
It pretty much looks like an ordinary drill site. I don't know that the average person – well, I don't know how often people see oil and gas drill sites. But when you do, I don't think you would notice any particular difference. It's one of many processes that they're doing, except that you might see a lot of water trucks pulling up because it takes millions of gallons, tanker loads of – of water, and shale takes a particularly large amount of water.
And where do they put this water? Into a giant cannon-like thing?
They just jam it down the well bore,
mm-hmm.
and then blast it out at high pressure into the rock, and then they suck it back out. And that water sometimes can be even more dangerous than the chemicals that people are talking about putting in. There's some nasty chemicals under the surface that are particularly nasty once they see the light of day. So getting rid of what they call produced water is another big issue in fracturing and drilling.
So they have to add a chemical, or the companies do add a chemical to the water they're injecting into the ground. Why do they have to do that?
They add a lot of chemicals.
A lot of chemicals.
It reduces friction in the pipe. It prevents rust. Any number of reasons. It's a very small amount of the solution or suspension or whatever it is, but these companies guard this information very closely apparently slight changes in what your additives are can change the yield in the gas that you get out. So, you know, that mixture is considered a proprietary trade secret by a lot of these companies.
I've heard it compared to the secret formula for Coca-Cola, that a successful chemical mix could mean, you know, millions and millions of dollars, tens of
right.
millions of dollars.
And that's the comparison that gets made, is that Coke doesn't give out its formula, but it does give out its ingredients. And that's where we're at in a pretty heated discussion in Washington about disclosure of these chemicals.
Could they do this process without any chemicals at all? Would just water make this work?
Well, it's water and sand.
Water and sand.
Probably not. I've never, to tell you the truth, asked that question. But you have thickening agents. These chemicals enhance the ability to do it. It causes enough problems for them that if they could do it with water and sand, they would. And they don't appear to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. This has been going on for quite some time out west. You mentioned the Texas case. Has it taken a long time to get here, and why is it now just coming to our attention here in the east?
Okay, well, and that's the key. It's coming to your attention in the east.
Mm-hmm.
We have to separate out shale and fracturing. Fracturing is a process that, as you mentioned, has been used for decades. I was talking with people at the Ohio Oil and Gas Association yesterday who were pointing out fracturing has been done in the sandstone layers there since 1953. The difference is that they have found this way to tap shale, which is a very common rock that has a lot of gas but was impenetrable before. And there's a lot of shale in the east, which is not that surprising. Gas, oil was, production of oil was first discovered in Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
about 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago.
So it's just where it's being used now in the shale that's causing the controversy. And the controversy is all because of contaminating groundwater. What has happened at some of these sites?
Well, you have people who say that their groundwater, has been contaminated. It has smelly globs. It smells like gasoline. It smells like methane. People say that they've gotten sick. One woman in one case got a rare adrenal tumor after her well blew up while it was being fracked. Well, her water well blew up while a gas well on her property was being fracked. Now, the industry will say that there has never been a confirmed case by regulators, a confirmed case of water contamination, definitively. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that there has been, but it's never been confirmed by state regulators. But a lot of times, in the past, these state regulators have worked for commissions that are dominated by oil and gas. You take Colorado, where I used to report for, and. A few years ago, the commission was populated entirely by people with oil and gas industry experience. Now, they changed that in 2007, and they're changing their procedures and laws now, too.
We're speaking with Mike Sorahan. He's an environment and energy reporter for GreenWire. We're talking about the process called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, the process of using water, sand, and some chemicals to split apart underground shale and then extract the natural gas. There are predictions that the shale here in the eastern part of the country could produce enough natural gas for the United States for 100 years. We touched on it briefly earlier, but is it the chemicals they're using that critics claim contaminates the groundwater, or is it the process of breaking apart this rock that contaminates the groundwater, according to the critics?
It's the chemicals they're using, and that can include things as toxic as, say, benzene. Another chemical that has been used called 2BE, and that's what's been connected to some of these cancer cases. Of course, it's also in some household cleaning products, and so that's what regulators have told some of these folks. Your exposure to 2BE must have come from using 409. And then there's a lot of other much more inert ingredients. Companies like to point to that they use guar gum as a thickener. Guar gum is what you use to thicken ice cream, mm-hmm. and it thickens frac fluid.
Okay. What are the regulation efforts taking place right now? Where does the federal EPA come down on this hydraulic fracturing?
Right. Well, EPA is studying it. The Congress in 2005 exempted it. It had never from the Safe Drinking Water Act. Fracturing had never been really covered by the Safe Drinking Act, except in one state where an appeals court said it should apply. That worried the industry, and they went to Congress to ask them to put in law that fracturing cannot be regulated by the EPA under the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Is this the so-called Halliburton loophole that I've read about? Yes.
Yeah. Halliburton, at the time, there was only three main companies that did this, Halliburton, BJ, and Schlumberger, and only Halliburton was actively lobbying on the issue. And I think that's why it got that mm-hmm. title, along with the fame that it got.
Yes. If you're going to give a title to something, Halliburton's a good – if you're opposing it, Halliburton's a good name to put in front of it.
Exactly. So it's generally been state regulation, and the states have regulated in different ways, and environmentalists and some community groups say that that has not only been different but insufficient and in some cases a little bit far too deferential to industry. States say industry says this is a perfectly safe procedure that has been well regulated by states for a long time.
And the ingredients in the chemicals, that's another effort that folks are trying to pry into to find out what's going on there.
The disclosure?
Yes, disclosure.
What's happening in Congress, and it's heading more toward this disclosure, but what's happening in Congress is Diana DeGette from Colorado, Senator Casey from Pennsylvania have introduced legislation that would remove that language exempting fracturing under the Safe Drinking Water Act and requiring disclosure of all the chemicals and saying this has to be on the Internet. And that has been opposed by the industry. To hear them talk, their main worry is that the feds will get involved and that they'll have federal regulation instead of state regulation. And they don't want to deal with the EPA.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. We have one quick question from Mark for you, Mike Sorahan from GreenWire, which reports on the environment and energy. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Mike. I appreciate your work. And two quick questions for you. You might have an idea on one or the other. In terms of the fracking, I'm concerned about a number of issues, including the earthquake potential. A book from the University of Texas at Austin, Texas Earthquakes, deals with injection and withdrawal of fluids inducing or affecting earthquakes. And also the question of the microbiotic organisms in the rock layers and how this process would affect them, particularly with the materials injected. And those microorganisms do actually tend to control geological processes, as Vernadsky discussed in his research.
Okay.
If you had a thought on those two, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you for the call, Mark. Earthquakes and microorganisms.
Well, the guests who are coming up have much more scientific knowledge about this stuff than I do.
Okay.
I'm much more a student of the political process. I have not heard of earthquakes being caused by oil and gas fracturing. I have heard of earthquakes being caused by other forms of underground injection, most famously to me, out at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, where they manufactured chemical weapons during World War II. And in terms of microorganisms, I know that there's a great deal of concern about what comes up with this water called produced water, that some of the chemicals that are in the rock are much worse when they come up than anything that oil and gas companies put down the well.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mike Sorhan. He's an environment and energy reporter for GreenWire, laying the groundwork as we talk about hydraulic fracturing here on WOSU. Mike, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk to two experts on either side of this issue as we just continue our discussion of this new, well, not so new, but newly worrisome process of extracting natural gas from shale in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. That's when All Sides continues on WOSU.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At noon, Fresh Air will be here. Billy West is the voice behind the animated characters of Doug, Ren and Stimpy, Bugs Bunny, and most of the male members of Futurama, which is back on the air with new episodes. That discussion and Peter Lawfer on Americans with Weird Pets. That discussion on Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents a special Chefs in the City coffee tasting at Luck Brothers Coffee House in Grandview. The event is Thursday, July 29th at 10:30 a.m. Join us to sample gourmet coffees and be a part of a special WOSU TV production. A limited number of tickets are on sale now. Get more information at wosu.org/chefs. 83 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:23. Sunny skies today and a high of 92. A slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 70. A better chance of rain tomorrow and a high of 90 degrees. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about hydraulic fracturing. That's the process by which energy companies blast millions of gallons of water and sand and some chemicals into the earth to break up underground shale, and that's to extract natural gas from that shale. The potential is enormous as far as the amount of natural gas that can be produced from this process, but there are worries about contaminating groundwater. It's important here in Ohio because about a third to maybe a half of Ohio sits on the Marcellus Shale, basically the eastern third of Ohio sits on this shale, as does a lot of Pennsylvania and upstate New York and all of West Virginia. So this has a lot of potential for the nation as a whole as far as energy production and also the economy of Ohio as far as these drilling operations are concerned. Joining us now is Lee Fuller. He is the executive director of Energy In Depth, which represents gas and oil producers around the country. Lee, welcome to All Sides.
Oh, thank you very much.
You obviously believe fracking and this hydraulic fracturing is a safe process.
Yes, I do. It's been in use in one form or another for about 60 years. It's been regulated throughout that time as a part of the well construction process. Probably been over a million fracturing jobs done, and it's far more sophisticated now than it was when it got started.
How much of this is taking place with regards to the shale and the natural gas extraction in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and West Virginia? How common is this process in this part of the country?
Oh, well, when you're dealing with shale, and in fact, most wells now, there's some fracturing process. The process for developing shale essentially involves drilling down the 1 or 2 miles into the ground where the shale formation is, and then the combination of introducing horizontal drilling technology that turns the well bore from a vertical inclination to a horizontal one, and basically drills through the shale formation and then segmentedly fractures that formation, is what really allows that shale gas to be developed. So mm-hmm. it's a linchpin to the development of shale gas, but it's also used in other types of formations and has been, as mm-hmm. I said, for 60 years.
Is it increasingly being used on this Marcellus Shale in the eastern part of the country?
It has to be used. Those formations are not really producible without hydraulic fracturing. They're just so tight, so dense, that the real capability to allow the shale formations of the Marcellus to be producing natural gas operations hinges on hydraulic fracturing. So all of those Marcellus shale wells would involve hydraulic fracturing as well as horizontal drilling.
Our guest, Lee Fuller, Executive Director of Energy in Depth, which represents gas and oil producers, smaller gas and oil producers around the country. Lee, how do you explain the complaints from residents, some residents, that their groundwater is contaminated because of this fracking process?
Well, I don't believe it's the fracking process that's causing their groundwater problem or their drinking water problems. When these things have been investigated, they've never shown that fracturing is the process that's caused or the incident that's caused their groundwater problems. When you're drilling, what's important here is understand when you're drilling a well, as you go through the drinking water segments of the geological strata, you put in additional casing, steel pipe, and cement it in place so that the well bore is essentially separated physically from the water. The fracturing process is taking place now a mile, 2 miles below that, and the only pathway really out of that is through the well bore, and that barrier is put in place. That type of barrier has been used since before you had fracturing, because there's always been concerns in the drilling process and the producing process of segregating material coming up the well, oil, produced water, natural gas, from getting into groundwater. So when these things have been investigated, they've not shown that fracturing is the cause of their problem.
Let's bring in another voice into the conversation, Wes Wilson. He's a former EPA engineer who is critical of hydraulic fracturing. He requested whistleblower protection when he questioned an EPA study that said that fracking was safe. Wes, welcome to All Sides.
Welcome. Thank you.
You disagree. You have serious questions about whether fracking causes groundwater contamination.
Well, it's not just me that has serious questions. It's EPA itself now. Thanks to the Obama administration, they're back on the job and begun a study in March that'll take almost 2 years to look at whether there's some both poor well construction, as Mr. Fuller just referred to, and systemic problems. And I particularly invite your listeners to look at the Hazen and Sawyer report done for New York City's water supply. That concluded that there was a risk, a systemic risk, from lack of geologic separation, even when you're a mile and a half down. It's what's known as brittle geology there. And Mr. Fuller is just absolutely wrong when he says the only pathway on a frack well is back up the well bore. There are other pathways, and there's the potential for the gas to migrate vertically with inadequate geologic seal.
So, Wes, is your concern with the makeup of the liquid that is being pumped into the ground or the process itself allowing other chemicals to contaminate?
Well, it's all of it, yes. Certainly the makeup of the chemicals being proprietary, they're not well understood. The list that the New York State EIS provided of some 400 or 500 chemicals, two-thirds of them aren't known with respect to their toxicity. But many that are known are carcinogenic and toxic.
I would add that the New York Environmental Impact Statement, when it was released, did not indicate they had any problems with the fracturing process itself threatening their groundwater.
Well, the industry's fond of saying it's not due to the fracking process itself. But if you're a contaminated individual on the surface, that's really irrelevant. Mr. Fuller may be right that the problems of these drinking water wells getting contaminated may be to another part of the drilling cycle. But that's what needs to be investigated. Now, I remind your listeners that endemic Pennsylvania, the Department of Environmental Protection there in Pennsylvania, has proved that it's thermogenic gas, it's gas from the industry arriving at the surface. And just yesterday, the Pennsylvania DEP gave its largest fine in its history, $400,000, to a blowout that occurred in June 3rd on a Marcellus shale while it was being fracked.
No, that's incorrect. The fracturing process had been completed on that particular situation.
It was a frack well. It had 300,000 PSI, and it came to the surface.
But it was a frack well, the fracturing process had ended. The fracturing equipment was gone. What they were doing was finishing off the well, as they have to do for any kind of well.
It's a distinction without a difference. This
no,
was a
it
blowout.
Is. No, well, there's an absolute distinction. There's an absolute distinction because this is a common problem whenever you're finishing off a well, that you have to have a blowout preventer
right.
in it.
We're getting,
the blowout preventer had a failure that happened. It had nothing to do with the fracturing.
It was a consequence.
We're getting way too detailed on this process for our listeners. Let's take a time out, Mr. Fuller. Let's talk about these chemicals. Do you need the chemicals to be added to the water to do this fracking process?
What the chemicals do, understand what you're doing is you're taking water and sand and mixing it together, and then you're pushing it, you know, down the wellbore and into the hydraulic fracturing area. What the chemicals do, a variety of things. Some of them are algaecides and biocides too, because you're dealing with raw water in most cases, and you have to, you know, treat the water, make sure you're not putting contaminants that would cause your well to close up in the well. Others are designed to put the sand in suspension with the water, so that when you're pushing it down into the well, it holds together. So that when you do the fracturing process and you're pushing the proppant, the sand, and the water into the fracture that you create, that it all goes in. And then you have to change that chemistry, in effect, so that you bring the water out and leave the sand in. So the chemicals are used as a part of the functioning to make the fracturing process work.
But some of these chemicals are dangerous, correct?
I'm sorry?
Some of these chemicals are toxic?
Some can be toxic in high concentrations. They have to be handled in that fashion. But the real question is how do you prevent those chemicals from affecting the environment? The two things that you do in the wellbore itself is to create a barrier, and at the surface you have to manage it properly to make sure that it's handled there. That management process is also regulated.
This is a
program that has been in this process of drilling and developing wells has been in play for decades. The environmental regulations, environmental structures around them have been in play for decades, and the fracturing process is a temporal part of the overall drilling and production process.
Mr. Wilson, what's your take on these chemicals? Could fracking be used without them?
Well, that's not clear. I think Mr. Fuller is absolutely correct in explaining the broad array of what the chemicals do, and particularly these thickening agents that then have to be followed by breaking agents in order to bring the water back up and leave the sand and prop it in the ground. That's the question before the FRAC Act, is to disclose them and understand their toxicity.
Lee Fuller, why not disclose these chemicals? I know there's arguments of a trade secret, but some of these chemicals are toxic, why not just lay it out there, here's what we're using, and here's why we need them?
Well, I think there's a couple of challenges there. One is we've tried to put a lot of information about the kinds of chemicals that are involved and on the Energy in Depth website, for example, and the relative concentrations that are there compared to water and sand. The actual disclosure issue gets complicated because you are dealing with proprietary business information that is not under the control in terms of its release by the producer, or in many cases by the service company. It's the chemical manufacturer that makes it. So they provide the material safety data sheet information on the nature of the chemical, what kind of hazards that are there. That information is certainly available to the regulators. The real key, however, going back once again, is how do you protect the environment from the chemicals, whatever they may be? Recognize when you're developing a well, you're putting in a small amount of fracturing chemicals, but you're going to be bringing back produced water from the well that in many cases can have chemicals that you have to guard against as well. So the real challenge is not particularly the chemicals, it's whether the chemicals move into the environment in a way that creates harm.
How do you stop that from happening? I mean, once you blast the water in there, how do you
well,
stop that from happening?
That's why you put bare. I'm sorry, say again.
Now, how do you stop that from happening? How do you stop that
from happening? The
contamination of water from the produced water.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. When you drill the wellbore and you're going through the groundwater, you put in barriers. You put in steel casing. You put in cementing. You create a barrier between the well bore and the groundwater. When you bring it to the surface, you have to manage it at the surface in tanks or pits in such a way that it prevents percolation from moving into the groundwater. Those are technologies that exist. Those are technologies that are used. They're designed to do exactly what they're intended to do, which is to keep the environmental risk manageable associated with production of oil and natural gas.
Wes Wilson,
yeah, let me answer
will that work?
One aspect of that. He's correct with respect if the well is done properly, and we just discussed the potential for lack of geologic separation. But there's another pathway here that could be systemic. When the produced water, including fracking fluid, is brought back to the surface, it's most often returned to a pit right next to the well. So that creates an air pathway of volatilizing toxic chemicals coming off of that open pit. And work done by Dr. Teresa Coons at the St. Mary's Sacramento Research Institute here in Grand Junction showed that benzene during an uncontrolled flowback presented a public health risk to just 250 meters away. And it was a non-cancerous risk that could occur to an individual in just several days. So EPA needs to focus on that pathway as a potential public health concern due to these type of fracking procedures.
We're talking about hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, the process of extracting natural gas from shale under Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and West Virginia. Just a couple of minutes left here. Lee Fuller from Energy in Depth, which represents gas and oil producers. Why did the industry need exemption from the Clean Water Act a few years back to do this?
Well, you're talking, I think, about the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Safe Drinking Water Act, I'm sorry.
The Safe Drinking Water Act was never designed to deal with well construction, well stimulation. It was designed to deal in the oil and gas area with the management of produced water that comes back up as a part of the process. Much like it was never designed to deal with natural gas storage as part of the underground injection program. And when a court in the 11th Circuit Court in an Alabama case said that the definition of underground injection was broad enough to cover hydraulic fracturing, then it triggered the potential for regulatory processes under a law that was never designed to deal with. What Congress did in 2005 was to clarify that hydraulic fracturing was not within the scope of underground injection, that was be dealt with by different regulatory regimes, as it has been since its inception.
But if this process could affect drinking water, why wouldn't it fall under the Drinking Water Act?
It's a question. It's a question of the underground injection control program is a particular part of the Safe Drinking Water Act that deals with the disposition of materials into underground formations. It's not just a generic cover-all that deals with anything that affects drinking.
Wes Wilson, from the former EPA engineer who's critical of this process, is there any way, because this really does hold a great deal of potential for generating a lot of energy, for a great energy source and protecting the environment and everything else, is there any way this can be done without harming the environment, in your opinion?
Yes, I think that is the challenge to the industry, to clean up its act and come to the 21st century. There are some best management practices like bringing these produced waters back to a complete tank each rather than an open pit that would prevent that air pathway. There is a need to make sure there's adequate geologic separation from the fracking zone to the surface so that unwanted methane gas doesn't come vertically. So it is quite possible that it could be done in a much better way to prevent these risks.
Okay. Thanks very much to Lee Fuller from Energy in Depth and Wes Wilson, a former EPA engineer critical of this fracking process. Thanks for joining us on All Sides.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about the recent court ruling that has George Carlin perhaps smiling from above a little bit, the seven dirty words decision that came down this week. When All Sides continues on WOSU NPR News.
All right, everybody, front and center. The next Fresh Air, Billy West, the man behind the animated characters of Doug, Ren and Stimpy, Bugs Bunny, countless celebrity voices on Howard Stern, and several characters on Futurama, which is back on the air with new episodes. That and Peter Lawfer on Americans with Weird Pets. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. See the new lineup of public affairs programming Friday nights from WOSU TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
84 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 92. A chance of rain tonight, just a slight chance, a low of 70 degrees. Rain more likely for Friday, and a high of 90. This is WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. I think many of us consider ourselves to be proficient in taboo language, dirty words. But our next guest is a nationally recognized expert. No, he's not a sailor or a truck driver. He's a professor at Ohio State's College of Law, Christopher Fairman. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you very much.
Chris Fairman has studied government censorship of any kind, in particular the seven dirty words. In other words, the seven dirty words, of course, those are George Carlin's words, that the U.S. Supreme Court said we cannot say on the radio. We are speaking to Professor Fairman because of this week's federal court ruling that struck down the Bush administration's very zealous interpretation of that Supreme Court ruling. Chris, what does this mean? What does the ruling this week mean for broadcasters?
The decision that happened earlier this week by the Second Circuit is a landmark victory for free speech advocates around the country. What it does is it continues what's been a multi-year process of the broadcasters striking back at the FCC's use of its indecency policy to restrict the use of broadcasters to broadcast programming that they think is appropriate.
This is the whole fleeting expletive crackdown.
The fleeting expletive is one component of what happened, but the Second Circuit decision reaches beyond the fleeting expletive and really puts a hold on the entire indecency program that the FCC was implementing.
In the near term, does this change the industry at all?
It has the potential to change the industry. Of course, the decision to use or not use certain language is both a legal decision and one that's also a business decision on the part of many broadcasters. And so I don't think what we're going to see is a massive influx of more dirty words on television or on the radio. But what it does do is it eliminates what has been considered the most serious problem, which is a chilling effect. Mm-hmm. That is a resistance by broadcasters to use programming out of a fear that they may be subjected to FCC fines.
If you'd like to join in our conversation, 292-8513, 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the recent federal court ruling that says that broadcasters, in essence, can air some of these words and not face penalties from the FCC. Of course, this will likely move higher into the courts, but that's where we stand right now. This started with an award show. This case involved an award show, and it was a broadcast live. I forget which network it was, and one of the – I think it was Bono or somebody else said a bad word and didn't get caught in time.
Right. This is a multi-year piece of litigation. It began with an incident that happened in 2004. There was a fine imposed by the FCC, or actually an order that would said it was indecent. Actually, they forego the fine. And then they issue an omnibus order attacking a number of other events, including award shows from 2002 and 2003 that predated the Bono Award Show. And in this omnibus order, the FCC established what was really a new policy, a shift from what had been their consistent requirement that use of dirty words had to be more than fleeting. It had to be a repeated use, much like the George Carlin monologue, where it was repeated use of words over and over again. They shifted from that policy and adopted a new policy that said a single use, like the Bono example, was actionable. And that's what really sent the broadcasters into a tizzy, because they were unable to guarantee that every single award winner might not make an expletive when picking up their award.
But the broadcasters did take steps to try to address this by delaying their broadcasters. I think the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction during the Super Bowl also contributed to this.
Right, and all the accompanying costs that go along with that. And of course, what the broadcasters have argued all along is it's impossible for them to always stamp out every fleeting expletive, but they've done a good job of using technology to be able to try and limit its exposure.
If you were watching the NBA Finals or the NBA playoffs, I think if you listen carefully, you could hear examples of that. Microphones are very close to the court. When covering basketball, whenever there was an expletive, you heard, 8 or 10 seconds, perhaps as long as that, of dead air, of no sound at all. You couldn't even hear the announcers.
Yeah, I think that's one of the issues that the broadcasters have really harped on, is that this is not like they're trying to play George Carlin's monologue at 6 o'clock in the afternoon where everybody's going to be able to hear it. Their concern has really been about the fleeting expletives. The court's ruling, though, I think goes much, much further than that and really strikes down all of the uncertainty, in essence, the vagueness that was involved with the statute or not the implementation of the policy by the FCC.
Mm-hmm. There was some different enforcement of it. The classic cases, you could say the F word, or they were ABC, I think, broadcast Saving Private Ryan, the movie starring Tom Hanks and Matt Damon, in which the F word was used in combat situations. That was okay, but when the F word was used in the PBS miniseries The Blues, it was not okay.
Yeah, that's exactly the sort of vagueness that is at the heart of what the Second Circuit has said in its opinion this week. The example that you used of Tom Hanks and the Blues is really the best parallel. In both of those situations, the FCC said that the language used was inherently sexual, even though I think to most people they would think that the use of the F word in that context was not sexual. But the FCC's policy says that it was. And then it began to track the fact that it was used a variety of ways to shock, to pander, and to otherwise violate sort of that standard that they had created of what community standards were for the medium. The difference is that, and this is the great irony, that they claimed that it was necessary for the realistic portrayal of the battlefield mm-hmm. in the fictional movie Saving Private Ryan. But when real blues musicians were using it to describe real events in their real lives, it was found to be too much. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of uncertainty that led the Second Circuit to say this is not a policy where a broadcaster can predict what's going to happen if it's going to air programming.
I mean, it goes back to the original ruling where basically I know obscenity when I see it. And that's not a very good legal thing on which to base decisions.
It's quite similar to that. Of course, obscenity is another category of the law that's used also to target certain types of broadcasts. And this is a sort of a step down below obscenity. Indecent language is entitled to full protection of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I think this is a step back in the right direction to provide that type of protection.
If you'd like to join in our conversation, you can send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. You can take part in the discussion on Facebook, and also you can call us at 292-8513. Let's go to the phones. Carol has a question.
Yeah, I just wondered how is it going to affect the broadcasting at WOSU, a live show like this one, because since all this happened, I noticed you started doing your delayed broadcast, mm-hmm. and many times I end up hearing repeated things because you get two programs or two things broadcasting at the same time anymore. Maybe that's a fact of it being digital now. But sometimes you'll start and then it'll stop and then it'll start to repeat the whole thing over again. And I don't recall that your show was doing delayed broadcasting, but I know Fred Anderle was still on his show mm-hmm. when you started it about the time that they started all these absurd rulings about, profanity. Profanity is part of life, and who are we fooling that it doesn't go on? But you guys have changed the way you broadcast this show particularly because of these rulings. I'm convinced of it because that's why you're doing the delayed broadcast.
All right. I'll try to answer your question, Carol. Thanks for the call. A very good question, because we get a lot of questions about our delayed broadcast. The delayed broadcast is two things. One is, is the digital broadcasting, but we did implement a delay mechanism. And we'll let the secret out now. For years, we did not have a delay mechanism. And when we moved to our new facility, brand new studios, our engineers took that opportunity to install the delay dump button. I have a big button. For some reason, it has an A on it. I don't know. It should have an F on it, I think. But it has an A on it. And if somebody says a bad word, I hit that button. And what it does is it basically wipes out, 5 to 7 seconds of what was just on the air. So we can get rid of those bad words. I'll admit that one of the urgent reasons why it was part of our new studio design was the FCC ruling, because these fines can be pretty hefty. And if they're cracking down, we have to be conscious of that. But all that being said, we are still going to use the dump button. We just think from editorially, it's in bad taste for the talk program and for our, any kind of live call-in program to have those words on the air. So we'll do our best to eliminate them, and we'll keep the delay just because I think that, it's in poor taste and we're trying to be civil discussion and things like that. Now, on the other hand, I was watching Frontline, the PBS documentary show, a few weeks back, and they did a very compelling story of soldiers in Afghanistan or Iraq. I forget now. I think it was Afghanistan. And the F word was used pretty freely there, Professor Fairman, but it was used after 10 o'clock at night. And that's a difference that it's in the law.
Right. It would come into the safe harbor provision, which would allow the broadcast of those words after 10 p.m. The issue that the caller raises, I think, is one that is worthy of attention, because one of the things that we had to discuss prior to this broadcast was whether we would actually be using the words that the court opinion uses and were at issue.
Mm-hmm. And in the title of your book, which begins with F and ends in CK.
Right. A book title that we can't announce over the air, but has a nice long subtitle that helps me do some publicity. Uh-huh. But these are real questions about whether or not, as a culture, we're going to allow the taboo that makes us resistant to hear those words, whether we're going to rise above that and be able to at least talk about words that we think may or may not be appropriate.
292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. Lamar has a question. I'm not going to put Lamar on the air because I don't want to have to use my dump button. He asks, what are the seven dirty words? All I can suggest, Lamar, is you type in George Carlin, seven dirty words on YouTube, and there they are. So those are the words we can't say on the radio or television, and we're not going to say them here. But thanks, thanks for the inquiry.
Interesting, though, that when the FCC's policy was originally limited to just those seven words, for almost 10 years, there wasn't a single enforcement action. There was a great clarity in what could and could not be broadcast, and it was simply those seven words couldn't, anything else could. It was the policy shift away from that certainty which led to the issue that we have today.
Where does this case go? Will it be back before the Supreme Court, do you think?
Well, this is a case that has already been to the Supreme Court once. It had a Second Circuit ruling that found the policy was impermissible on administrative agency grounds, on procedural reasons. Went up to the Supreme Court in 2009, and the court in a 5-4 decision said no, the agency was given deference in deciding that there was a rational basis for the reason that they were making the change the policy, that is protecting children, or a fear of increased use of dirty words if they didn't implement the now fleeting expletive target. Now with this ruling, it's going to be up to the agency to make a determination about whether or not it wants to take the case back up. We have a change of administrations, although I've seen nothing that makes me think the Obama administration is kinder toward indecent language than the Bush administration, although I think the agency itself is not as much as a zealot. We don't have any of the dramatic enforcement cases have not come out since the change in administration.
What kind of fines were we looking at when this was being implemented, enforced strictly?
When the shift in the policy happened, we jumped from $400,000 in fines in 2003 to $8 million in fines in 2004. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines that could be imposed against an individual broadcaster for each broadcast of the offensive programming.
Now, the folks who advocate for, more quality television, that trying to protect kids who are watching TV shows, they're concerned this could open up, the floodgates. I mean, are we going to see HBO-like dialogue on sitcoms or on American Idol, which is a live show.
You know, that concern has always been part of, I think, what has helped support the idea of increased regulation on language, this fear that the floodgates are going to open up and we're going to have dirty words all over all of our broadcasting. The fact of the matter is, just as this radio station is, most broadcasters are responsible, and they recognize that their audiences don't want to hear that language at all times of the day on all types of programming. And so the industry itself will self-regulate. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have that great fear. The flip side of that is, should programming be available, like a documentary, The Blues, that uses some profane language, be available during non-watershed hours to the viewing public? And I think the answer there is yes.
Mm-hmm. You've seen the disclaimers that go, this program contains explicit language. And sometimes I think they use that as a marketing tool to get people to want to watch these programs because they know it's going to be edgy. But you look at some broadcasters in this increasingly fragmented broadcasting world. You look at, and I don't think the big networks fall into this category, but your third tier network, or your second tier network, I should say, you know, maybe they could use that as their brand, to be the edgy network where you use these words on the air more often in their animated shows or their sitcoms, things like that.
I think we need to look then at the reality of what the media world looks like today, which is a very different picture than it looked like in the 1970s when the Pacifica case came down and the rise of the indecency regulation came up. No longer is television and radio the predominant way in which people get their information. We have cable, we have satellite, and we have the internet, all industries that are not regulated on the basis of indecent language. And so I don't think there's going to be any lack of access to indecent language, whether the controls on broadcast continued or not. And so I think that we really have already seen the sort of differentiation of why Howard Stern's on satellite instead of on broadcast radio, moving their own programming to a place where they feel that they can work without the FCC over their shoulder.
I think the concern among, parent groups is that there is a safe haven on the broadcast channels, that they can plop their kid down in front of the TV at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and not have to worry about it, where they know they're not going to plop them down in front of HBO at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and feel the same security.
Well, the great gift we have now is that every television since 2000 has a V-chip in it, which allows the parents to control access to certain programming with language that they find offensive. And so technology has also outstripped the need to have the sort of regulations that were imposed by the FCC. The court, in its opinion, however, was clear that it was not striking down the policy because of its belief that technology had outstripped the rationale for it, because the Supreme Court said there's the authority to regulate indecent language, and that's true. It was struck down because of the vagueness in which the policy was being implemented.
Okay. And this Supreme Court has been a champion of free speech. I mean, the Citizens United case was a free speech case. As controversial as that was, it came down to a free speech thing. So was that an indication of how this might rule on this?
Free speech has always been one of those issues. It's hard to gauge the way the justices would vote. If I look back at the way the 5-4 split we had in the last time this case went up to the Supreme Court, there is one vote in the majority, which was Clarence Thomas, who is on record as saying he's wanting to revisit the indecency standard altogether. And I think he may be the fifth vote for reversal of the policy altogether if it goes up to the Supreme Court again.
Okay. Our guest this segment of All Sides has been OSU law professor Christopher Fairman. His book, I can't say what the title is, but you can guess, begins with F. It talks about the taboo and protecting First Amendment liberties on broadcasting, and it looks at this whole issue of using the 7 dirty words on television and radio. He's speaking at Northwest Library tonight on Hard Road at an ACLU event about this very topic at 6:30 if you want to check it out. Thanks, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time. This has been All Sides on WOSU 820. My thanks to Linda Taylor, Leticia Wiggins, and Amy Jurevich for helping me out during this week, filling in for Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson. Have a good day. This is WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at wosu.org.